Turning now to the book of Genesis, chapter 39, verse 1. Genesis, chapter 39, verse 1. And Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him down thither. And our subject is the training of Joseph. And here he is at the beginning of chapter 39, a bond slave in Egypt, sold into slavery, and yet by God's overruling, brought to the very place where God's purposes for him could be fulfilled over time. And he was found in the ownership of a powerful and rich, highly influential man. Short of Pharaoh, he could not have been better placed. And so in verse 2, we read, "The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian." Joseph clearly spoke Egyptian. We're not told that, but there are many hints in the earlier chapters of Genesis concerning the life of Abraham, and thinking of the easy interaction with the surrounding nations, there's every indication that Abraham's family were good linguists, and that they were familiar with the various languages of the region. And here we find Joseph settling in so remarkably and quickly, and being rapidly promoted, elevated in his slavery in the land of Egypt. So I think we can assume that he had a good command of Egyptian, though it isn't specifically said. But what a remarkable thing that as a slave and a young man, he was not simply put out in the field or cracking rocks or some hard menial service where no one would observe him and he would be forgotten and he would toil in hard labor all his days, but he was brought into the house of Potiphar and appointed to serve him as a slave there. And from the very beginning of chapter 39, you see the overruling, the sovereignty of God, God's superintendency in his life. And you see in verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph, indicating that he walked with him. And he was a prosperous man. And perhaps these days we're a little surprised to see that term, because he was a poor man. He had nothing. He'd been sold into slavery. He'd come into Egypt destitute. He was an owned person, carrying nothing with him. And yet prosperous is not a bad translation of the original of the Hebrew. It actually is a word which comes from pressing forward, being pushed forward. And some of the moderns try, he was a successful man. But prosperous is good if you think about it. When you think of the word prosper, it's to do with businesses. Imagine a small business, a shopkeeper, something like that. And somebody has to work very hard. And if he does work very hard, he can open another shop, then another. And he can increase his holdings and his trade and so on. But it takes sheer hard work for him to prosper. And that term prosper in the English language, actually originally, has in mind somebody who prospers by hard work, by effort. So it's not a bad word if you understand it in its old-fashioned sense to describe Joseph and to reflect the Hebrew. He was a prosperous man. He was a man who moved forward and proved himself by his utter honesty and his diligence and his hard work. And he was noticed, first by one overseer, then another, and promoted within the household, and came to the attention of Potiphar. And that's what we see and how we imagine it. And of course, it was all over time. But he was a prosperous man, a man who had achieved steady promotion by hard work, diligence, and notable integrity, which was very rare in that Egyptian culture and society. And it's noted he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Well, I've already commented on that. He was in the house, as opposed to the ground holdings and the fields and whatever it was they were doing, and the estate may even have had, some kind of area where they cut and hewed rocks and things like that. But he was in the house, and that was to his advantage, the overruling of the Lord. And in verse 3, his master saw that the Lord was with him. Now, how did the Egyptian Potiphar know that? Well, I suppose his superstition helped him. For somebody to be as patient as Joseph, and as honest, and as diligent, and as hard-working, though he was paid nothing, he was a slave, and yet he put his all into what he was given to do, with no motive for doing that, then there must be, in the mind of this superstitious Egyptian, a religious explanation. So to the best of his grasp and understanding of divine things, he assumed that God was with him. He was such a remarkable individual, the true God, the one out of all the gods that the Egyptians believed in, must be with him. And so he impresses himself upon Potiphar. And the Lord made all that he did to prosper, and it's that word again, in his hand. So don't underestimate Joseph's work and his effort and his diligence. It's behind these words. And verse 4, Joseph found grace in his sight, and he served him. He served him. He was not aggravated at being a servant. He'd been sold into slavery from a very rich family originally, as you well know. And yet here he serves to the best of his ability. You can almost see what the Lord is doing in this young man's life. He was conspicuous for godliness and character before he ever came into Egypt, but by giving him service, he's training him in humility. All the great ones in the culture of those days were spoiled by promotion and power and office, and people so often are today. But Joseph was kept in service. So even when he was given privileges and promotion and made chief executive officer of Potiphar's entire holdings, and he was a very rich man, he was still required to serve Potiphar and to be totally accountable to him and to regard him as the owner of all things. So he got used to wielding power while at the same time owning none of it. And that's surely great training for character, for somebody to be content, to be a humble slave in status, and yet wielding great power and bearing responsibility. And verse 4, he made him overseer over his house, and all that he had he put into his house hand. With the sole exception, it goes on to say, of what he ate and drank, which is, I'm sure, a way of saying that Potiphar only reserved to himself his very personal matters, the most personal aspects of his life. Everything else was put into Joseph's hands. So we think of this, because apart from other things, this is an illustration of God's sovereignty over his people. And here is Joseph, who falls into such calamitous circumstances, but you can see the hand of God, and you can see well what God is doing with him. He's training him. And we come into portions of our life when we're tempted to be very discontented because we're under authority, or we have to do things we didn't want to do, or the course of our life didn't quite proceed in the way we'd have chosen, so we're in difficulties. But if we're children of God and we're walking with him, God is sovereign over all things, and we're being trained for something, or strengthened, or prepared. And you see this providence in the life of Joseph. And then in verse 5, it came to pass from the time that he had made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. So this superstitious man, Potiphar, became even more convinced that his sudden upsurge in holdings and riches and prosperity was on account of Joseph, that he had achieved these things, but not just he, but the God who he served. So there's a tremendous testimony to Potiphar at that time, and it bears on the future also, but it's evident to him that God is with him. And so in the last part of verse 5, you note that Joseph has authority not only over the household affairs, the palace it would have been for somebody in this high station, but also in the field, his estate holdings, which would doubtless have been extensive. And there's verse 6, where it tells us that only his very personal aspects of life were not ruled by Joseph. And then this terrible passage from verse 7 of Potiphar's wife casting her eyes upon Joseph. As dear old Matthew Henry points out, sin began in the eye. We can pause there, can't we? Sin begins with gazing at something, looking at something, visualizing, imagining something. Sin begins noticing things that should not be being noticed. And so it was with Potiphar's wife. At the end of verse 6, it notes that Joseph was a goodly person and well favored. And the only other two people in the entire Bible of whom that is said is King David and, of course, Absalom. And so Joseph is one of three people so strongly described as handsome. And so Potiphar's wife begins to lust after him, and she tries to entice him, and he's subject to almost continual temptation. His refusal in verse 8 is also instructive, where he gives three reasons why he cannot possibly submit to this wife of Potiphar's. One is that he's a person who's been entrusted by his master, Potiphar, and he's got to keep that trust and be faithful to it. The second appears to be that the lady is a wife, so that rules it out entirely. She is the one thing that has not been placed under Joseph's control. And then he comments, how then can he do this great wickedness and sin against God? He sees sin as primarily against God. But she persists and persists, and I won't go into the details because I'm sure you know them, how one day he went into that palace to sort something out, and there happened to be no other close servants there to see the truth of what took place. And she tries to entice him and grasps hold of his garment, and he runs from the house and leaves it in her hand. And in her anger and fury, she uses this garment against him and charges him with attempted rape. And then in due course tells Potiphar when he returns to the house, and he is furious. His wrath is kindled. But as many people point out, he does not do what we expect him to do. He should have had Joseph executed at once, but he doesn't do that. And Joseph doesn't appear to defend himself. And the question is often asked, why does Joseph not defend himself? Well, to defend himself would involve incriminating Potiphar's wife and being against her and accusing her of lust and lying. Now, perhaps he does not feel he can do that, because just as Potiphar is his master, she also is his employer, in a sense, and over him. But equally, perhaps he reasons that it wouldn't do any good. It would only dig the whole pit deeper if he sought to bring the wife into disgrace. So his tongue is bound, and he cannot raise any defence. And perhaps that helps him with Potiphar also, because in verse 20, instead of execution, which would have been the certain outcome in the Egyptian culture, Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison. It turns out in the next chapter to be the prison over which Potiphar has control, a place where the king's prisoners were bound. In other words, people of note, people of special status. And they were bound, though, they were chained there as a punishment, and he was there in the prison. We don't know for how long before the next event took place, but he was there in the prison, bound with the others. It says so later. And so he was plunged down from his high responsibility and position. And he must have thought, well, everything was going so well. And he had the oracles, those dreams he'd had when he was home earlier on, that his brothers and his family would one day bow down to him. I don't think those dreams interested Joseph in terms of indicating his superiority over them. But to him, I'm sure, he interpreted those dreams as meaning that one day, in time of great need, perhaps he guessed famine, something like that, in time of great need, he would be the deliverer of his family. The dreams were surely, he knew, of God. And he knew that he would achieve high station and be a great deliverer. And these dreams were an enormous comfort to him. And perhaps he'd thought often while in the service of Potiphar, my dreams are going to prove true. I'm going to be promoted and be significant. I must work hard for that, because the ultimate purpose is somehow the deliverance of the people of God. And here he is now plunged down once again and imprisoned, and everything crashes and everything seems to be lost. But no, he isn't disillusioned. His faith holds very clearly, and the Lord was with Joseph, verse 21, and showed him mercy and gave him favour in the sight of the keeper of the prison. That's a very telling verse. The Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favour. We might expect to read, and delivered him from the prison. But it doesn't say that. He left him in the prison, in the place of hardship and darkness, in a dungeon. But while there, he gave him favour in the sight of the keeper of the prison. Our deliverances are not always the deliverances we expect. Our comforts are not always the things that we might imagine they ought to be. But God will not fail us. And in this case, he's going to be there for a while, but he's going to have favour in the sight of the keeper. And exactly the same thing happens, as you know, in the prison, as happened in Potiphar's house. The keeper of the prison, verse 22, commits to Joseph's hand, clearly over time, all the prisoners that were in the prison. And he is in charge, I almost said, of their welfare, if you can say welfare, of an Egyptian prison. But he is in charge of their existence there. And anything that happens in regard to them, well, Joseph is responsible. And in the final verse of chapter 39, the keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, under Joseph's hand. He could trust him entirely because the Lord was with him, and the Lord made everything he did to prosper. And so he is in prison, wondering what the next phase will bring and what will happen. So chapter 40. It came to pass after these things that the butler, I shall go quickly because I'm sure you are familiar with these passages, that the butler of the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, and his baker had offended their lord, the king of Egypt. Now, it turns out that this is the chief butler and the chief baker. So they're no mean personages. They're important people. This is the Pharaoh's cupbearer, no less. This is the one who runs all the butlers and the carers and the food tasters and, well, probably a lot of functions in Pharaoh's enormous palace. And the baker also is a man of great stature. He's more than a practical baker. He's head of all the kitchens and the food and the ordering. He really, I shouldn't think, puts his own hand to any food preparation ever. He's too important for that. What have they done? Well, we're not told. But they've greatly angered Pharaoh. And you can only imagine that they've been engaged in some kind of fraud. It is something serious, I'm sure. And they've used their office or misused it, and they've been making money or somehow entering into contracts and things of that kind which were to their advantage. And anyway, that's only a guess, but Pharaoh is offended at them greatly, and he has them to be punished, thrown into prison. So he's extremely angry. Verse 3, he put them in ward, this is chapter 40, in the house of the captain of the guard, so it's Potiphar again, the captain of the guard, into the prison, the place where Joseph was bound. But that is meant to be in the past tense, because I don't think he can actually be bound now, because he's a kind of administrator caring for the other prisoners. His chains have been undone now, and he's risen within the prison. So he's still, as in Potiphar's house, where for all his responsibility, he was still a slave, and he served. Now he's in the prison, and he's pretty well running the prison, but he is still himself a prisoner. What a way to train somebody in humility, to give them the training, the responsibility, the practice in administration, and yet leave them with the most lowly status. And that's what happened to Joseph, so that he would remain a godly and a holy man even when he was elevated to the very highest office in the land at the head of the empire. And verse 4, the captain of the guard charged Joseph with these prisoners, and he served them. He had to look after them. Though they were in chains, and he possibly was no longer in chains, it was made clear to him they were very important people, and he was in effect serving them. And they continued a season in ward, in their confinement. And they dreamed a dream, each of them. You know the dreams, and you know how they were, and I won't go into them this evening, but the butler or chief butler and the chief baker, and they were deeply concerned at these dreams. They realized they were more than dreams or nightmares, and they looked so miserable. Verse 6, Joseph looked at them and they were sad. Joseph was a very compassionate, sympathetic man. He asked Pharaoh's officers that were with him in the ward of his lord's house, saying, "Wherefore look ye so sadly today?" And they said unto him, "We've dreamed a dream." And they describe it to him. And the chief butler told his dream to Joseph, who had said, "Do not interpretations belong to God?" He realized this was a God-sent dream. And for the one, for the chief butler, there was to be release in his dream, so Joseph tells him, and restoration to his office. But for the chief baker, there was to be judgment. That must have had a terrible effect upon him. But Joseph, in verse 14, says to the chief butler, "But think on me when it shall be well with thee, and show kindness, I pray thee, unto me, and make mention of me unto Pharaoh, and bring me out of this house." And he doesn't say, "For I was wronged when I was falsely accused by Potiphar's wife." He doesn't accuse her. He doesn't say that. He gives his reason, takes it back much earlier. "For indeed I was stolen away out of the land of the Hebrews." You could make much out of that term, by the way, the land of the Hebrews. whatever does he mean? That he was stolen from the land of the Hebrews. It was the land of Canaan. It wasn't the land of the Hebrews. The Hebrews were just nomads in the land, wandering from place to place. But the old writers used to love to observe this in Joseph's mind, because he knew the promises given to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. It was the land of the Hebrews. He was speaking in terms of the promise, not yet fulfilled, but the great promise said, it's the land not of the Canaanites, but of the Hebrews. And that's what he says to the chief butler, that he was stolen. But you know that didn't happen. The chief butler, when he was released and restored, forgot him. Well, I don't suppose he completely forgot him, but every time he remembered the dream and how it had turned out to be true, he brushed it aside. He wasn't interested in helping Joseph or taking any risks upon himself. And so comes Pharaoh's birthday. Egyptian pharaohs celebrated birthdays in a big way throughout every successive Egyptian rule. And it came to pass, verse 20, the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast unto all his servants. And he restored the chief butler, and he hanged the chief baker. Verse 22. But Joseph was forgotten. But now, chapter 41, 2 years later, evidently, how many years had elapsed before the dreams of the butler and the baker, we don't know. But it came to pass at the end of 2 full years after their restoration that Pharaoh dreamed, and behold, he stood by a river. The river Nile, obviously, is the only river that matters in Egypt. And by the way, we may find ourselves in a position in life which is difficult for us and protracted, and like Joseph, at least 2 years pass, and some people think it was more than 2 years. However, can't be too long because of the age that is given of Joseph a little later. But he had to exercise patience. And then there were the dreams of Pharaoh. Very interesting. We haven't time to go into them in detail, but they involve the Nile. And the more you read the dreams of Pharaoh, with hindsight, of course we know what they mean, but with hindsight we can look at them and say, well, in the context, they should have been pretty easy to interpret. This is to do with the Nile, the source of all the fertility of Egypt. And this has got to be about prosperity and crops and famine and need. Thin cattle, fat cattle, same with the corn and so on. This has got to be about famine and about preceded by prosperity and everything that depends upon the Nile. So why could not all the wise men of Egypt figure it out? When you read the dreams, read them again and again. They're not that difficult, but I know we are speaking with the advantage of hindsight. They seem quite obvious that all the wise men and the magicians are blinded, evidently by God, in understanding something that was an oracle, a divine warning. And so it is today. There are some extraordinarily clever people, as you know, who are the high priests of atheism, and they know so much, and they can argue so expertly, and yet there are obvious things they simply cannot see, as though they're under a kind of judicial blinding. They don't understand about human depravity. They don't understand the meaning of the conscience. They don't understand about human personality and how it is that we come to be as we are and behave as we do. They can't see it at all. And some of the cleverest people in the world and the greatest academics produce recipes and means of social and human improvement that are really so ridiculous to even the simplest Christian who understands the basics about human nature, as though they're blinded. They say such foolish things. And yet you have to say, this man and this one and that one, far cleverer than I am, and far more learned, and how can they get such obvious things so patently and transparently wrong? So here, all the brains of Egypt, the most advanced civilization of the day, could not grasp these, frankly, pretty easy oracles and dreams. And they were blinded. And there is a judicial blinding operating, as we read in Romans 1, which makes clever people extraordinarily dull when their whole minds are tipped against God and against spiritual truth. And you see it here, but that's a digression. So here are the dreams from the Nile, and they're interpreted to Pharaoh that there are going to be 7 prosperous years and 7 very lean years. And as the result of these dreams, Pharaoh is so stunned by Joseph's wisdom and his record, he's obviously told something of his record, that he appoints him to be the one who will supervise the storing of the goods and the surplus harvests and make sure it's all done properly and that the land has much in store. And Joseph proceeds to conduct a detailed survey of Egypt. Let me tell you a few respects here in which Joseph is, I think, undoubtedly a type of Christ. And we were mentioning last study how sad it is that even many Bible-believing evangelical scholars and writers are very shy these days about seeing Joseph as a type of Christ. The old writers were never so hesitant. But just so many respects. Here is a favourite son sold into slavery, the favourite son of the family, and rightly so, because he was the godly one and the obedient one, and he's a type of Christ, favourite son of the Father, only son. Of course, the favourite of heaven comes down into humiliation for us. Joseph, the righteous one. You see chapter 38, the dreadful sinfulness of Judah, his brother. And in the previous chapter, the sinfulness of all the other brothers and their murderous, selfish ways. And here is Joseph standing out for righteousness. Of course, he was a man. He was a sinner too, like us. But that isn't recorded. He's presented in the scripture in all his righteousness. And in that, he's a type of Christ. He gains remarkable success despite his poverty. And in that, he's a type of Christ. Here is our Lord and Saviour Jesus Christ, comes into the world, a son of a carpenter, a poor man, and yet he has fame and acclamation until the time of his ultimate humiliation through his miracles, through his powers, through his teaching. He moves the entire country as no one else has ever done. And in that, his success through poverty, Joseph is a type of Christ. In his defeat of temptation, he is subjected to constant temptation, Joseph. Discontent, dissatisfaction, grumbling and murmuring against God because of the hard circumstances he has to bear. And then the temptations that are put before him by Potiphar's wife. But he resists them all, as Christ did, the one who resisted all temptation. Then he's falsely accused, and so was Christ, our Saviour. And when he's accused, he opens not his mouth, according to the record, and nor did Christ, because it was the will of his father and his own will that he should go to Calvary. And then, even in small respects, there is Joseph vindicated by the officers who find him faithful. And so was Christ vindicated by the Roman centurion at his cross. And there is Joseph numbered with the transgressors, in prison with the two thieves, imprisoned and numbered as a transgressor, and so was Christ. And there is Joseph, he's suffering all this. What for? Ultimately, for his brethren. Because through this, he's going to come to the notice of Pharaoh, be elevated, and be the one who is in a high position, able to redeem his sinful brethren when they come for corn. So his suffering, ultimately, is for his brethren. And so, of course, is Christ's. He's suffering on Calvary, not for himself, but for his people, his brethren. There are so many senses in which Joseph, not in any far-fetched way, step by step through his life, is typical of Christ. Everything that Joseph predicted comes to pass. Everything that Christ predicted comes to pass. He is exalted over all the land, and so is Christ exalted over all the world and the heavens when he's as he ascends into his Father's glory. So many things parallel and are true. Three times Joseph undergoes a kind of resurrection, and that's very significant. From the pit, he rises, as it were, from the dead when he's brought out of the pit into which he's been cast by his brothers. He rises again from slavery as he prospers in the house of Potiphar. And then he rises from prison when he's delivered, comes to the notice of Pharaoh. Now, it's very interesting that the Apostle Paul in Acts 26 says that the resurrection is in the books of Moses. Not only the prophets, but Moses also. That the things of Christ, and he specifies the resurrection, is in the books of Moses. Well, the challenge from of old is this. If the resurrection of Christ is not to be seen in the typical life of Joseph, effectively raised from the dead, and three times, and you can choose which resurrection you wish if you want only one of them, if it isn't to be seen in the life of Joseph, where is there a resurrection that could in any way portray the resurrection of Christ in the books of Joseph? If it isn't here in the life of Joseph, and one of his resurrection or all of his seeming resurrection experiences as a type, a picture, a foreshadowing, a prophecy, where is it? The Apostle Paul, and it can't be so, will have got it wrong. And this is put very delightfully by Dean John Bergen in one of his great sermons at the very beginning of the 20th century. And he exclaims, where, tell me, he says to the critics who don't think that Joseph is a type of Christ, tell me, where is the resurrection in the books of Moses if it isn't in his life? Well, of course it is. It's there. Joseph is a foreshadowing and a prophecy of the life of Christ. And so he is raised up. And I can just glance as we come to conclusion at chapter 41. Here is him coming to the notice of Pharaoh. Here is his interpretation and application of the dream of Pharaoh. It's a very interesting verses in chapter 41, by the way. Verse 14. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon, and he shaved himself and changed his raiment and came in unto Pharaoh. I remember once being in the United States many, many years ago, and I saw hanging in the porch of a church there a sign which very elegantly addressed men and women and said, they should come well, properly clothed, decently attired into the house of God. And the proof text given at the bottom of this instruction was Genesis 41:14. Well, I didn't know what it was, obviously, just in my head, but I made a note of it. And I looked it up later, and I found it was this verse, taken right out of context. True, but it's not a bad motto text, is it? Gentlemen, listen to this. Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon, and he shaved himself, and changed his raiment, and came in unto Pharaoh. That's not bad. It is taken out of context. But if you're coming to the house of God, be shaved and tidy. It's the house of God, not the house of Pharaoh. It's infinitely more important. Well, I think it's a good proof text anyway. And sometimes you go to a pastor's meeting, a fraternal, and you find men there looking like tramps. I think that's all. So, always well turned out. And it always amuses me, you know, when you see the weather gets warm and there are some pastors, and I think it's shocking, really, they go straight into T-shirts. And then you see our brethren who we support, our dear Ghanaian pastors and other African pastors, in the sweltering heat there, you see pictures of them all with their smart suits and shirts and ties. And there's no excuse for people becoming sloppy in a temperate climate like ours. Anyway, that's a digression. And remember Genesis 41:14. It's a good motto text. Well, we can go through this chapter, but we're out of time. And you see here that Joseph is given great authority. Verse 34 of chapter 41 concerns people. And here it's recorded, "Let Pharaoh do this," says Joseph. "Let him appoint officers over the land and take up the fifth part of the land of Egypt in the seven plenteous years." And people tend to pounce on that. Surely you'd want a seventh part, they say. If you're going to collect a fraction of the produce for the protecting against the lean years, you want more than that. And not a seventh, but much more than the fifth. But of course, the explanation is that there, even in the lean years, there'll be a harvest. There'll be some crops, there'll be some grain, so a fifth will be quite enough in all probability. But I want to conclude taking you down to the end of chapter 41 and verse 51. Joseph now, he's raised to a most important position. He's all sorts of splendid multicoloured garments put on him, and he's given a wife. And now he has children during the prosperous years. And Joseph called the name of his firstborn Manasseh. "For God," said he, and this is the meaning of the name, "hath made me forget all my toil and all my father's house." So Manasseh is given a name which is a memorial of the fact that Joseph has been lifted above slavery now, and certainly lifted above all fear of his brothers. That's in the long past. Doesn't mean he's forgotten his father's house. That is still the family of God. And the name of the second, verse 52, is Ephraim. "For God hath caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction." So his resurrection is completed. Resurrection from humiliation, from hostility, from punishment. A type of the Redeemer, a demonstration of providential oversight, which is a comfort to us all, the training and the care of God. Look at the people God used in the training of Joseph. Think of some of them. You think of the brothers. Hateful, murderous conduct. And yet what they did was essential to the life of Joseph. and his ultimate position as Redeemer of Israel, but that's in later chapters. Then there's Potiphar's wife, evil woman, and yet she is going to be in the hand of God. She doesn't know it. So instrumental in the future life of Joseph. And so is that head butler and head baker. We don't know what they did. No doubt something evil, wicked, like theft, fraud. Such people are going to be instrumental in the life of Joseph, bringing him to an ultimate position of being able to redeem and save the people of God. So it is with you and me. Your worst enemy, the person who afflicts you most. Well, just think about it sometimes. In the sovereignty of God, that person may be used in a way you cannot see or understand to your lasting benefit and blessing and usefulness to God, because he is sovereign over your life and uses all these things. So not only do we see in these chapters Joseph as a great type of Christ, but we see the providence of God training a person through very difficult circumstances, and that is a tremendous encouragement to us to trust the Lord for everything. Let's close this evening singing the hymn 535.